The H1N1 flu pandemic eventually killed 50 million people a century ago, about 675,000 of them in the United States. The current pandemic has claimed at least 748,000 lives worldwide, about 163,000 of them in the United States, according to a tally kept by the Washington Post. AMC Theaters is attempting to lure customers back into movie theaters with 15-cent tickets. Dr. Anthony Fauci has warned that if the country allows coronavirus infections to run rampant to achieve possible herd immunity, the death toll would be massive, especially among vulnerable people. The CDC's ensemble forecast now projects nearly 189,000 U.S. coronavirus deaths by September 5th. There are more than 5.2 million cases and 160,000 deaths in the country. Now, here are some short stories. Texas's COVID-19 positivity rate drops below 20%. The seven-day positivity rate in Texas has dropped to 16.08%, according to the latest data released by the Texas Department of State Health Services. The positivity rate in the state has been over 20% for the past week. During a news conference in Lubbock on Thursday, Governor Greg Abbott said that Texas's DSHS is looking into why the positivity rate has been so high recently. First, during the month of July, there were several surge testing operations where we dramatically increased the amount of testing in different regions at different periods of time, and that led to a very abundant number of tests that were done, Abbott said. At the same time, however, we saw a lot of people, a lot of residents in different regions, step toward wanting to get tested. We have observed for the past couple of weeks a decline in the number of people stepping forward to get tested. Coronavirus surges back into nursing homes. The novel coronavirus is surging back into U.S. nursing homes, where it killed tens of thousands at the start of the pandemic, and once again threatens some of the people most vulnerable to COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. The development is a discouraging result of widespread community transmission of the virus in many parts of the country, and in hotspots where it is even less controlled, with staff, and in some cases, patients and visitors, entering and leaving facilities, the community-acquired infection almost inevitably finds its way inside. The strongest predictor of whether or not we'll see cases in a particular setting is community spread, said Dr. C. Grabowski, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School who studies long-term care. We saw that in the Northeast, and now, unfortunately, we're seeing it in the Sunbelt states. More than 650 whistleblower emails pour in after Georgia lawmaker sets up account for school concerns. Georgia State Representative Beth Moore, Democrat, established a whistleblower email for teachers, students, and administrative staff last week, and it now has more than 650 messages of complaint about unsafe school conditions, Moore told CBS 46 on Thursday night. Moore told the station that she created the email address that provides anonymity in response to the viral images of maskless students crowding a North Paulding High School hallway. The students who shared the images were suspended, though the Paulding County School District later confirmed the suspensions had been rescinded. This is an effort to make sure that if and when Georgia schools go back to face-to-face instruction, that we do so safely, Moore told CBS 46. Moore researches and verifies a whistleblower's association with a school before posting messages online that sometimes names specific schools and school districts. The recession is over for the rich, but the working class is struggling. U.S. stocks are hovering near record high, a stunning comeback since March that underscores a new phase the economy has entered. The wealthy have mostly recovered. The bottom half remain far from it. This dichotomy is evident in many facets of the economy, especially in employment. Jobs are fully back for the highest wage earners, but fewer than half the jobs lost this spring have returned for those making less than $20 an hour, according to a new labor data analysis by John Friedman, an economics professor at Brown University and the co-director of Opportunity Insights. Though recessions almost always hit lower-wage workers the hardest, the pandemic is causing especially large gaps between the rich and poor and between white and minority households. It is also widening the gap between big and small businesses. Some of the largest companies, like Nike and Best Buy, are enjoying their highest stock prices ever, while many smaller businesses fight for survival. More than 70% of students have been negatively affected by coronavirus, analysis finds. The International Labor Organization, ILO, has warned that the coronavirus pandemic may have a devastating effect on the education and training of young people. In a new report, the UN agency said more than 70% of students have been negatively affected by the closures of schools, universities, and other institutions, such as training centers. Almost 20% have had no courses, teaching, or tests since the onset of the pandemic. Half of all students impacted by the closures fear their studies will be delayed, according to the ILO report. The coronavirus has widened inequality between higher and lower income families around the world, but the impact has been most severe in low-income nations. Whereas video lectures were accessible for more than 60% of students in high-income nations, less than 20% of students in low-income countries have had access. Now from the Associated Press, Texas hospitalizations below 7,000 for first time in weeks. Texas reported fewer than 7,000 hospitalized coronavirus patients for the first time in 6 weeks Thursday. But that encouraging sign was clouded by questions over testing as schools reopen and as college football teams push ahead with playing this fall. Testing has dropped off in Texas, a trend seen across the U.S., as health experts worry that people who are not symptomatic are not bothering to seek tests because of long lines and the prospect of waiting days to get results. Demand has curtailed to the point that in Austin and Dallas, health officials have expanded eligibility for testing, including those who are asymptomatic. But there remain grim reminders of the toll the virus took on Texas this summer. COVID-19 deaths have risen by more than 30% in August, including 255 new reported deaths Thursday, and hospitals on the hard-hit Texas border remain busy with coronavirus patients, even as doctors statewide are handling thousands of fewer COVID-19 cases than a month ago. Now this from the Texas Tribune. Governor Greg Abbott says coronavirus hospitalizations and positive cases must decrease before he'll allow bars to reopen in Texas. Governor Greg Abbott expressed his sympathy for Texans who are now unemployed following his order closing bars during a press conference on Thursday afternoon, but stressed that those areas cause some of the most prolific spreading events. "When you go to bars, you don't go in there and go to an isolated location," Abbott said. "People come together. When you're drinking, you're not wearing a mask. You're taking your mask off. After you've had several drinks, some people become fairly intoxicated and less likely to use discipline that is needed to make sure they are avoiding spreading COVID-19." Abbott said he's read or talked with infectious disease doctors who rate bars a leading transmission zone. In late June, after a recent surge of Texas coronavirus cases, the governor shut down bars for a second time and scaled restaurant capacity to 50%. On Thursday, he said bars could potentially reopen once coronavirus metrics improve more significantly. He said he would need to see the state's positivity rate drop below 10% for a sustained period of time and for hospitalizations to decrease. This story now from the Texas Tribune. Governor Abbott says Texas is investigating its high proportion of coronavirus tests coming back positive. In response to Texas's recently plummeting coronavirus testing numbers and heightened rate of people testing positive, Governor Greg Abbott said Thursday that state health officials were investigating the trend and working to increase the number of Texans being tested for coronavirus. We have far more daily testing capacity than there are tests being undertaken, because we're not having people step forward to be tested as we did before, Abbott said at a press conference in Lubbock. Abbott offered one possible explanation, the closure of some temporary testing sites created in July that targeted various coronavirus hotspots. State officials last week deployed four testing locations in Houston, each capable of processing up to 1,250 samples per day for about 2 weeks. The state's official tally of coronavirus tests shot up dramatically on Wednesday after a consistent decline over the past weeks. The overall trend of a decline in testing has left public health experts worried about the state's ability to contain or even track the spread of the virus as schools across the state are considering how to reopen for the fall. In the week ending August 11th, an average of about 35,000 coronavirus tests were administered in Texas each day, a drop of about 45% from 2 weeks earlier, when the average number of daily tests was around 64,000. Now, this story from the Texas Tribune, the crushing isolation of nursing homes during the pandemic. After 70 years of marriage, the coronavirus tore Margie and Werner Stahlbaum apart. But Margie, who was tested positive for COVID-19, wasn't the one who died. It was Werner, of natural causes, and maybe of loneliness. In early June, when 87-year-old Margie tested positive for the virus in the Cedar Park nursing home where they lived together, she was transferred to a different facility in nearby Round Rock to be isolated. When their granddaughter, Serena Bumpus, visited Werner during that period, she talked to him through a window. Werner, who was 88 years old with dementia, would point at his wife's empty bed, looking as if he didn't know what was going on. Part of me wonders, and the rest of my family wonders, did he think she had already passed? Said Bumpus, who is a nurse. And he just thought, it's time for me to go be with her. The coronavirus pandemic has been a constant and precarious balancing act between limiting the spread of the virus and the need for life to go on. In few places has this balance been more delicate than in long-term care facilities, where elderly and medically fragile residents have been deprived of visits from loved ones for almost 5 months. For some families, the wait is ending as the state rolls out new rules to allow visitation again in certain nursing homes and assisted living facilities. But it remains unclear how many facilities can or will start allowing visits. And some families say the damage to their loved ones from prolonged isolation has already been done. As the pandemic reached the U.S. and began ravaging nursing homes soon after, most states with coronavirus outbreaks closed visitation at long-term care facilities. Recently, some states have begun allowing visitors again as the COVID-19 curve flattened. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott shut down visitation in mid-March. That order remained in effect for 145 days until August 6th, when the state eased restrictions for facilities that don't have any active COVID-19 cases among residents or confirmed cases among staff in the last 2 weeks. Of Texas's 1,215 nursing homes, 56% still had active cases on Thursday, while more than 15% of the 2,000 assisted living facilities have reported active infections. Once a facility determines it can allow visitors, the next step is to get approval from the state if it decides to resume visitation, and that's up to each facility, Texas Health and Human Services spokesperson Kelly Weldon said in an email. Weldon added that the state doesn't yet have a list of facilities that have been approved to resume visitation. It's up to families to contact the facilities to find out whether they are able to allow limited visitation. Even facilities that meet the requirements cannot allow physical contact between residents and visitors, state officials said. For many families, this is not acceptable. My mom has Alzheimer's. She is nonverbal, says Jenny Lutzel, whose mother, Paula, is in an assisted living facility in Rockwall, near Dallas. Everything in her world is sensory, sensory touch, sensory communication, and we can't touch. COVID-19 has been so devastating in long-term care, with close to 22,000 infections and over 3,100 deaths in Texas since the beginning of the pandemic, that facilities are fearful of allowing any visitors and wary of putting more pressure on their staff, who will have to supervise every minute of the visits, said Jude Goodson, former executive director of Orchard Park at South Fork, an assisted living facility south of Houston. Goodson said the pandemic has put facilities under tremendous financial pressure because of expenses like protective equipment for staff and technology to keep the residents in touch with their families. Meanwhile, revenues have dropped because of fewer new admissions and more deaths, she said. With severe financial issues, where is that extra staff to manage visitations going to come from? Goodson said. Roadblocks to visits. Abbott's March order halting visitation didn't halt the spread of COVID-19 among some of the state's most at-risk residents. After the governor allowed businesses to gradually reopen in May and June, infections in nursing homes and assisted living facilities soared. In July, more than 11,000 of their residents were infected and 1,350 died, more than four times the totals for June. While families were banned from entering the facilities, infected staff members brought the virus to work with them, health experts say. Once inside a facility, it spreads like a wildfire. Phil Wilson, the acting executive director for the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, said during a webinar about the new visitation rules on August 7th. The visitation rules are taking effect even as cases in nursing homes and assisted living centers are still growing, with deaths in long-term care facilities still making up for a third of the state's overall toll. More than 1,100 new cases have been reported over the past week, a 54% drop compared to the last week of July, which saw some of the highest case numbers of the pandemic, but still more than double the weekly average for June. Under the new rules, in addition to being COVID-free, nursing homes, the hardest hit facilities, will also have to test their staff every week, which has become difficult to achieve because of limited access to testing. Testing has been an ongoing challenge. Kevin Warren, president and CEO of the Texas Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care facilities, said last week after the new rules were published. Facilities can perform their own testing using federal funds allocated for COVID-19, but without that federal money, Warren said it can cost facilities up to $15,000 a week to perform tests. In July, the state tested all residents and staff in only about 7% of long-term care facilities, either through requests by the facilities or through quick response teams the state deployed after outbreaks were reported. In August, the state plans to test residents at 9% of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. At the end of July, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services started sending devices to nursing homes that can perform antigen tests on the spot within minutes. 372 have been allocated so far at Texas's more than 1,200 nursing homes. Antigen tests are taken by nasal or throat swab like other tests, and while faster, they generate more false negative results than the other kind of test. But the new requirement to test all staff weekly could be a catch-22 for nursing homes. Those with no active cases aren't prioritized to receive those testing devices. I don't see how a nursing facility can test staff weekly without point-of-care testing with the federally supplied devices, said Patty Dukayet, the state's long-term care ombudsman, adding that she has no evidence that the state is fulfilling the remaining need. Isolation kills too. Lutzel said she has been visiting her mom through a window since March, I know they're doing everything they can, but there is just no substitute for a family member, she said. Scientists have long studied the effect of social interaction on the brain. The pandemic has offered a grim occasion to measure the consequences of the lack of interaction. Isolation can lead to mental and physical decline, said Dr. Carmel Dyer, professor and executive director of the Consortium on Aging at UT Health in Houston. Anxiety and depression increase with social isolation. One thing that our brains like the most is social interaction, says Dr. Janice Nebel, professor in geriatrics at the University of North Texas Health Science Center at Fort Worth. Both said several of their patients in long-term care have shown signs of declining health at a much faster pace than the normal course of aging or dementia. Leora and Aretha Carter have also noticed the rapid decline of their mom, Willie Mae Carter, who is in Ridgecrest Retirement and Healthcare in Waco, during their weekly through-the-window visits. She had dementia, but could still recognize us, even if it took a minute. Now she won't even get up out of a chair. I understand she's 90 years old, but it occurred so quickly, Leora Carter said. She had a chance to do an outside visit with her mother in mid-May, but being 6 feet apart was hard, and the ritual hug to say goodbye was impossible. Dyer said people with moderate to severe dementia are not always aware of the reasons why their loved ones can't visit or hug them and might feel abandoned. The new state rules allow for a failure to thrive exception to the visitation ban, which has to be documented and is only allowed at facilities that meet the other requirements. Under the exception, if a physician diagnoses a decline in a resident's physical or mental health, one person can be designated to be the sole visitor for that person, and not just in end-of-life situations, as has been the case. Signs of a failure to thrive include weight loss, decreased appetite, poor nutrition, and inactivity, reads the new emergency rules for nursing facilities. For Renee Griggs, the fact that rules are different for different facilities creates a lot of confusion. Her mother suffers from dementia and lives in an assisted living facility called the Grand View of Chisholm Trail in Fort Worth. When she talked to the facility on Friday, they didn't even know if they could or were going to allow visits. Griggs said her mother has lost 16 pounds since January, and she's gone from remembering her daughter to being disoriented and incontinent. Even though COVID itself is not killing my mom, the consequences of the disease are killing her, she said. She picked her mother up last week on Friday for an essential doctor's appointment. She still has not driven her back to the facility. I just couldn't do that, she said. The Stahlbaum family thinks Werner Stahlbaum could be another victim of the virus who never contracted it. Margie Stahlbaum was her husband's lifeline, and putting her in quarantine took away the one person who kept things familiar, Bumpus said. They had never been apart for so long, she added, and Werner's health declined quickly after his wife was transferred. Bumpus had a chance to visit her grandfather in his last hours because of the exception to the visitation ban for compassionate end-of-life care. Bumpus said what she saw still haunts her. She said she had never seen such a look of defeat on everyone's face, including residents and the staff. That day, Margie Stahlbaum was still waiting for a second test to come back negative so she could be reunited with her husband. She learned through a wrought iron fence, through masks and distance, that the love of her life was gone. She could hardly formulate a sentence after she returned to the Cedar Park facility, Bumpus said, adding that she believes isolation caused her grandmother to become disoriented. Only at Werner's funeral did it become clear that Margie didn't fully grasp what had happened. And so when she is rolled up to the casket to say goodbye, she looks at my aunt and says, "Oh my God, he died. Bumpus said. Now we're going to bring you a longer program that originated from NPR, a program that is called Throughline. This show will be a little over 20 minutes long. In the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, it's tempting to draw comparisons to the most severe pandemic in recent history, the 1918 flu. But as much as we can learn from the comparison, it's important to also understand just how much these two pandemics differ. The following piece will show what we can learn from what happened then, and just as importantly, where the comparison should end.
In the year 1025, a Persian Muslim physician named Abu Ali Sina wrote the influential Canon of Medicine, or in Arabic, Qanun. The book gathered much of the medical knowledge of that time and created a roadmap for recognizing and treating diseases, performing small surgeries, and even had a detailed section on herbal medicine.
The Canon of Medicine was used for centuries in the Middle East and Europe. William Osler, one of the founders of Johns Hopkins Hospital, called it the most famous medical textbook ever written, contending that it was a medical Bible for longer than any other work. This isn't hyperbole. Abu Ali Sina's approach to medicine laid the groundwork for the scientific method. He correctly identified the basic causes of stroke, the relationship between nerves and muscles, and even accurately describes the way the human heart functions.
Yet amazingly, from the time of Abu Ali Sina, human understanding of the unseen viruses and germs that fill our world remained virtually unchanged.
Until perhaps the 1850s, the 1860s, the 1870s, with the introduction by Lister of antiseptics that changed everything. And then we have Louis Pasteur, who develops pasteurizing, what we call pasteurization techniques. And there's this beginning of this germ theory. The microscope has now been around for a couple of hundred years. People understand bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so there is beginning of what we might see as a semblance of modern medicine, but it was a vastly different time and one that we should all be very grateful that we're not living in, at least from a medical perspective.
What was the state of medicine at this point in the world?
Well, there was no understanding of viruses as we know them today as these tiny particles, perhaps 1/20th the size of a bacteria. Huh. And so people spoke about viruses in terms of a poison, something that causes disease, without understanding exactly what that was. It's a time when hospitals are quite different. It's a time when there are no antibiotics. Huh. Your doctor was probably as likely to arrive on horseback. There was bloodletting, in which your doctor would slice into your vein and remove some of your blood on the basis that disease was a dis-ease. It was an imbalance of the four humors. And if you could remove blood, you would bring the patient back into some kind of balance and cure their disease. So everybody, one time or another, went to the doctor to get their blood let. So it was just a time that is almost inconceivably different to the time that we have today in terms of medicine and our understanding of disease.
What was going on in the world around the time the 1918 flu broke out? You know, what did the world look like?
Well, the world looked like a very sad place. It was 3-4 years now into the Great War. America had just come into the war in 1917, and mm-hmm. the war has now been going on for these many, many years, with the deaths of so many young men in every community virtually, certainly in Great Britain and in France. Germany, of course, suffered its own casualties. And then the United States was pulled into the war.
So when do people start actually hearing about this new flu and start paying attention to it?
So the first reports that we have in the U.S. about influenza actually are well documented, and they originate in Haskell County in southwest rural Kansas, 200 miles west of Wichita. And there, in January or February of 1918, a physician by the name of Loring Miner, who was a country doctor in rural Kansas, he noted that there was more and more of this disease called influenza. In fact, he noted that on one day, 18 people in his community had come down with influenza, and that 3 of those had died. And in a sparsely populated county like Haskell, this was a remarkable event, remarkable enough to prompt Dr. Miner to write a report to health officials, and that is the first recorded instance of a physician warning about the outbreak of influenza. From Haskell County, Kansas, the disease quickly spread outwards about 300 miles to the east to Camp Funston, where there was a U.S. Army camp. And we know that soon afterwards, around beginning of March, the first soldier at Camp Funston fell ill with influenza as soldiers moved freely between Funston and then civilian world and then other army camps. The virus expanded outwards in waves. So that is the first theory as to where ground zero was for the great influenza epidemic. There are at least two other theories as to where it originated. The second is that it actually originated in northern France. The virus passed from birds into an intermediate host and then into the human population. And from there, it seeded around the world to rear up and to show its ugly head all at once across the world in 1918. This theory has a lot of promise because it explains why communities that were very far apart from each other, like China and India and the United States and Africa, why these all these communities saw influenza in 1918 suddenly at the same time. There was, of course, no rapid international air travel. So how did the germ spread so quickly? And then the third possible place where this disease came from was actually from China. There are reports early in the year of a disease that resembles influenza in China. And that theory suggests that the disease originated there and then was brought to us, possibly by the large number of Chinese workers. About 140,000 Chinese workers were actually hired in a supporting capacity in the European theater of the Great War. And it's suggested that some of these people brought the disease with them. So three possibilities. Ground zero was right here in the good old US of A. It was in northern France. It was possibly in China. Each of these theories has good evidence to support it. And each of these theories also has weaknesses. And it's likely that we will never know for sure which is the correct one.
And how did it spread? How fast did it spread?
Well, it spread very fast. And I think it's fairly clear that it certainly spread with the large movement of soldiers from the military camps back and forth, both within the US and then over to Europe. And then you had soldiers that were coming back from Europe in boats, making their way back to the US for rest and recreation. And so you had this great intermingling of soldiers, young men from all across Europe. And it is likely that that was one of the important features and factors that allowed this disease to spread so very quickly.
I mean, this disease is often called the Spanish flu. You know, that's how a lot of people know it. But all the theories about its origins, as we heard, have nothing to do with Spain. You know, not a single one of them.
No. The Spanish flu certainly did not originate in Spain. So why was it, and sometimes to this day, why was it called the Spanish flu? And the answer is this. It was widely reported in newspapers in Spain, and that's where the first stories broke of this disease. Why wasn't it reported perhaps in other newspapers in the US or in Europe or in Great Britain? The answer is this. There was a tacit agreement between the governments of the Western powers and the newspaper editors not to report bad news.
Wow.
Certainly, there were reports of influenza, but they were generally small and often relegated to the back pages. And what we have, therefore, is an underreporting of influenza in the newspapers. Spain, to remind everybody, Spain was a neutral country in World War I. It did not have, therefore, this tacit agreement between its newspaper editors and its government not to report influenza. And so the first reports of influenza being widespread came out of Spain.
Yeah.
But this does not mean that the disease came from Spain. It certainly did not.
I'm wondering, you know, if I was someone living at that time and this disease was sweeping through, like, what would it have felt like to witness its spread?
Well, it must have been truly terrifying. For me, perhaps the most terrifying aspect of this illness was, as we were speaking about, people had no idea where it was coming from. So if we think of the word influenza, that word comes from the Italian influenza, meaning influence. And it reminds us that for many, many hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, people thought that you got sick because of a misalignment of the stars and of the planets Saturn and Jupiter. So The word influenza, meaning influence, means that we were under the influence of the stars, and that, as good as any other theory, was an explanation of why people were getting sick. So here you were, living in perhaps in very cramped conditions, in a tenement building in a city like Philadelphia or New York or San Francisco. As this disease was sweeping through the community, people were becoming sick, and you really had no idea what the causes were.
People had no idea what was killing them, how it started, or how to stop it. And with poor news coverage, no cure, and rumors running wild, fears were rampant. And it was anyone's guess how to stay safe. Over the past few weeks, we've quickly watched many parts of society shut down. Businesses, places of worship, schools, restaurants, gyms, professional sports leagues, and now even the Olympics have been postponed. But it turns out, all these social distancing measures aren't new. People in 1918 also started keeping their distance as the flu began to spread.
That's right. Back in 1918, similar things were done. People understood that there was something about interpersonal contact that made it more likely to catch the disease. And so churches were not meeting. Department stores were going to only have a staggered opening time so that people would only be allowed in at certain times and few people would be allowed in. Dance halls closed down. Places where people would gather to dance to the sound of a piano, those were closed down. Door-to-door salesmen, something that we really don't have anymore, but door-to-door salesmen trying perhaps to sell you an encyclopedia, those were banned. Funerals were banned. You could only have a couple of people attend a funeral. They didn't want too many people to gather together in that setting either.
Wow.
Newspapers of the times were full of articles recommending that people use handkerchiefs. There were reminders not to spit in public. That's another rather anachronistic feature of the disease, that back then spitting in public was actually outlawed, and you could be arrested for spitting in public. And there were signs that simply said, sleep well, eat well, play well, and don't worry, as if telling people in large letters not to worry would alleviate their worry. Mm-hmm. And so very quickly, this disease not only became the problem of those who were suffering from it, mm-hmm. but it really changed the shape of society.
Mm. So I read that the 1918 flu disproportionately impacted people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, young, healthy people. And we're so used to this idea that the flu kills the very young and the very old, but it must have been especially shocking for society to realize that its most productive population was most at risk.
Yes, the group of people who normally don't get complications, the young, healthy people, people in the workforce generally, they were, for whatever reason, more likely to suffer from the complications and have an increased mortality.
Right.
And so once that happened, that meant that people were being taken out of the workforce as either they were dying or they were ill or they were convalescing. And jobs couldn't be filled, so police had a hard time, you know, filling their patrols. And even things like the telephone system, which we take for granted today, back then the telephone system was rather primitive and you needed to route your call through an operator who would connect your call with a cable plugging you in. Well, those telephone operators were sick and couldn't get to work. And so, for example, the telephone exchange in Philadelphia shut down and said, we're only going to route calls of an emergency nature. We don't have the staff to do anything else. So even if you were lucky enough to have a telephone back then, it was even difficult to place a call to your friends or family elsewhere to see how they were doing. So it affected every part of life. I think it's very likely that everybody knew somebody who was ill and many people knew somebody who had died. One of the features that is very dramatic, as we said, was the fact that it took young, healthy people and very often killed them. The degree to which this was felt is the following. The average life expectancy in 1918, 1919 dropped. It dropped by 12 years. Just to put that into perspective, we've heard a lot about the terrible opioid epidemic that swept this country. And a couple of years ago, for the first time in a long, long time, our average life expectancy also dropped as a result of the terrible deaths of many young men and women who statistically brought the average life expectancy down in the U.S. by 0.1 of a year, one-tenth of a year. Mm-hmm. And we read a great deal about it. Imagine a disease that doesn't drop it by a point one of a year, but by 12 years. It's remarkable, and that is a feature of the 1918 virus. It dropped the average life expectancy in the US by 12 full years. There's a very dramatic eyewitness account that we have of the carnage that influenza caused by a very prominent physician at the time called Victor Vaughan, who was the dean of the medical school in the University of Michigan. And in his memoir, he wrote that the deadly influenza demonstrated the inferiority of human interventions in the destruction of human life. It's a very frightening description, and one that really brings us all to a very different place, a place that is very far from where we are today.
The flu appeared in the spring of 1918 and raged on until that summer. This was the first wave of the pandemic. The warmer months caused the seasonal flu to die down, but it quickly returned with a second wave in the fall when the temperature dropped again. The virus ran its course all the way into the beginning of 1919 and finally puttered out around February, a full year after it first began.
It's not easy to hear about the devastating impacts of the 1918 pandemic, especially while we're living through our own pandemic right now. But as Jeremy said before the break, we're in a very different place than we were 100 years ago. And it's really important to understand how the coronavirus is and is not like the 1918 flu. First, let's get through the similarities.
Number one, both are novel viruses. In 1918, we have a pretty good understanding now that the virus was a bird influenza virus that spent some time in an intermediate host, likely a pig or a horse, and then it crossed over into us, and that's how we got the 1918 influenza epidemic. And coronavirus appears to have originated in bats.
Right.
Then it crossed over through an intermediate animal. In this case, it seems to be the pangolin, which is a scaly anteater, a very cute but very endangered and commonly trafficked mammal. And then it spread out further into humans. The second similarity is that both are winter viruses. Coronaviruses are winter viruses and are likely to disappear as we get the warmer weather in the spring. That's why the 1918 influenza virus disappeared. But what happened then was it returned in the fall of 1918 in the second wave of the epidemic. Mm. The question is, what will happen to coronavirus? Will this then come back in the fall of this year or not? 1918 certainly did come back in the fall when it disappeared over the summer. Personally, I suspect we will see fewer and fewer cases as the warm weather comes around, because that's what happens every year with our winter viruses. So let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that that will be a feature of COVID-19 as well. Mm. And the third similarity between influenza of 1918 and the coronavirus is that it too has rapidly become a worldwide problem. So those are the three similarities, but let's pause for a moment and think about the differences between them, because I think the differences are in many ways more important than the similarities, and also provide us with reassurance. First of all, in our understanding of the virus, within about 2 weeks of the very first cases of coronavirus, a Chinese team had published the full genome of COVID-19 in a major US medical journal in English. Mm. And this goes to show just how quickly our understanding of at least what the virus was, of at least what the cause was, how quickly we got to it, and also how well there is this international sharing of data. So the first big difference, therefore, is in our understanding of the virus. The second big, big difference is in our treatments. As we've mentioned, in 1918, you were likely to get a whiskey, an enema, and perhaps some bloodletting from your doctor for your influenza. And it occurred, as we said, in the pre-antibiotic era. Coronavirus is here in the antibiotic era. Now, to remind everybody, the coronavirus is a virus, so giving you antibiotics to treat it are of no use whatsoever. But just like with influenza today and back in 1918, some people will get a complication from the infection, and that complication is commonly a bacterial pneumonia, and we have good antibiotics for bacterial pneumonias. So we are now living in an antibiotic era that did not exist back then, and that's a very big difference. As we think about medical treatments, we also have to remember that today we have hospitals and intensive care units. We have specially trained emergency medicine physicians who will quickly diagnose and treat your illness. We have intensive care physicians. We have pulmonologists who spend all day treating nothing but lung problems and lung infections. And we have infectious disease experts who can help fine-tune any treatment for infectious diseases. All this was, of course, unheard of even 50 years ago, let alone 100 years ago. So that's the second difference. And the final difference that I want to think about with you is the reporting. We've mentioned that in 1918 there was this tacit agreement between the government and the newspaper editors to keep the news of influenza epidemic off of the front page to as best as they could. Compare that with today, where we have heard nothing other than coronavirus on the front pages of our newspapers, on the top of our screens and on our feeds that we get electronically. We are living in a very different time. You can go online and see a real-time update of the number of cases worldwide, you know, that are updated perhaps every 12 or 24 hours. So our reporting of the illness is very, very different today than it was in 1918. And that is the third very important difference between coronavirus and the influenza epidemic of 1918.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of differences between then and now. But this comparison, you know, which was the starting point for this whole conversation, it worries people, you know, and some of that fear is warranted. Some of it isn't. So from your perspective, what are the things we shouldn't worry about as, you know, we deal with this pandemic? And how do we not let the panic overtake us?
Sure. I think your question points to another feature that I hadn't really discussed until now, but it's the feature of commonality between 1918 and 2020, and it's the fear. We mentioned that there were these large notices in newspapers that among the other helpful pieces of medical advice were don't worry, which probably didn't do very much to calm everybody down. And today we are also clearly experiencing a degree of discomfort, a degree of fear of the unknown. But this fear must be put in perspective. As I mentioned, we have an understanding of the virus. We have treatments that were unthinkable just a few decades ago. And we have an open reporting system that tells us how we're doing. Mm. But I think another key feature of the disease back then was this idea that we're all in this together. And the coronavirus of 2020 reminds us that however we may separate ourselves, whether by ethnicity as Americans or places of origin or how we vote or what we think about the economy or our feelings about whether we should have a decrease or an increase in the base tax rate, we can all agree that we are, at the end of the day, people who need to help each other. And this is a disease that I think has the possibility of bringing Americans together in a much-needed way. It's too bad it has to be in this way. But I think as a people, we can really rally around this and do great things and help each other.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing this book about 1918, were there any examples of resilience that we could draw from, you know, as we're dealing with coronavirus today?
Sadly, most of these things, most of these recollections are of how hard it was to pull through. It was a very, very difficult time, and we mustn't forget that. But one story or one picture that I like to recall is a picture of a group of Red Cross nurses, and they're putting together cloth masks. And in the background, there is a sign, and it says, "If I fail, he dies." And it's a reminder to these nurses that just putting together these masks, you're taking part in a life-saving chain that can make a difference to people, and that if you fail, somebody may actually die. It's a reminder of how we can take even the small things that we're doing, washing our hands, and really magnify that and say, okay, in a microcosm, this seems like a relatively insignificant activity to do. But of course, we know that multiplied across the U.S., these things are of great importance. If I fail, he dies. That was what the nurses in 1918 thought about as they were putting together these masks. We can perhaps think that we too today can do our bit so that there will be fewer examples of illness and death from coronavirus across the U.S.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Friday, August 14th, 2020. Next is national news from USA Today. And then local news coming up at 3. Here are some of the articles we'll be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, judge delays giving judgment in DA's suit. City reports 3 more deaths, 17 new cases. MISD says Long Staffer is district's 7th COVID case this month. High temperatures put 2020 in record book. Shooting memorial details to be revealed. From the Odessa American, educators tackle COVID issues. Swanner running for at-large. And OC adds new vice presidents. The Wall Street Journal will be on at 6 o'clock tonight. And at 7 o'clock, as we do on Fridays, we present a more lighthearted program after all of the heavy news that we bring to you day after day. This show is called The Lighter Side, and it's humorous articles and features. So we hope you'll join us for a little bit of a lighthearted nature as we go into the weekend, 7 o'clock tonight, on The Lighter Side. On Fridays, we like to send you off with a fun song. Earlier this week, Tuesday, American singer, guitarist, and actor Trini Lopez passed away from COVID-19. Trini Lopez was born in Dallas on May 13, 1937. He formed his first bands in Wichita Falls and then later moved to Dallas. And in fact, Trini Lopez worked at the Vegas Club, which was a nightclub owned by Jack Ruby, the nightclub owner who assassinated Lee Harvey Oswald. He had many hits, especially during the mid-60s. This was one of his most popular hits, one very early hit for him from 1963. Here is Texas's own Trini Lopez, If I Had a Hammer, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Have a great weekend. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
HEB, in partnership with Favor Delivery, started Friday a service that gives seniors access to a personal shopper by phone, allowing them to get essential food and supplies delivered to them while remaining in the comfort and safety of their home. Times are 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., 7 days a week. To access the senior support line, call 1-833-397-0080. Again, that number is 1-833-397-0080. To find out more about the program, visit favordelivery.com/senior.
This week on Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, Rodgers and Hammerstein's cinematic treasure, The Sound of Music.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
As I sound your signals, you will step forward and give your names. You, Fräulein, will listen carefully, learn their signals so you can call them when you want them.
The celebrated play that delighted the world with the performance of a lifetime by the screen's brightest star, Julie Andrews, in the glorious role of Maria.
How do you solve a problem like Maria?
Maria, who entered the strange new world of Captain Von Trapp and captivated his seven children with a magical spell of song.
Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes.
I am 16, going on 17, I know that I'm naive.
Oh, please, Captain, love them all.
I don't care to hear anything further from you about my children.
I am not finished yet,
Oh,
Captain.
Yes, you are.
Are you in love with him?
I don't know. The Baroness said I was. She said that he was in love with me, but I didn't want to believe it.
I love you.
So somewhere in my youth or childhood...
Here is the perfect motion picture that touches every note in the full scale of human emotions.
Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer star in the audio-described The Sound of Music. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 100 and clear. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Liz Hill, and this is your USA Today for Friday. First article of the morning is titled, President Trump Requests Mail-In Ballot for Upcoming Florida Primary, Despite Rhetoric. Written by Hannah Morse. For the second time as a Palm Beach County voter, President Donald Trump has requested a vote by mail ballot ahead of Florida's primary election on Tuesday. And the president, who has just spent the past few weeks eviscerating mail-in voting, has less than a week to cast it. The request for himself and First Lady Melania Trump came Wednesday, the Palm Beach County Elections website shows. The ballot would have been picked up, not mailed, to his Palm Beach private club, Mar-a-Lago, because the deadline to send out ballots has passed. Now it must travel to Washington, D.C., where the President and First Lady can vote, and then return before 7 p.m. Tuesday, when all mail-in ballots must be submitted. The election primarily involves choices for Democratic and Republican Party voters for such seats as County Commission, Port of Palm Beach, State Legislature, and Congress. However, the ballot also features judicial races and the election supervisor seat, which are all open to voters regardless of party affiliation. The President and First Lady can mark their choices for seven races, including for a congressional seat held by Liberal Democrat Lois Frankel. On the Republican ballot, the Trumps could choose from an array of candidates, including avid Trump supporter and conservative provocateur Laura Loomer, who has been banned from Twitter and raised more than $1 million for her campaign. Trump has blasted vote by mail, particularly universal vote by mail.